Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Podcast. It's Pradeep Mundra here. I'm a gastroenterologist from the UK and podcast host for this episode. Now, today's episode is about IBD and pregnancy. From a clinician's point of view, I feel there's generally a sense of unease, a bit of uncomfortableness and nervousness amongst clinicians in dealing with patients with IBD and pregnancy. And I suspect that's probably driven by our lack of knowledge in this topic, a lot of uncertainty in this area, and probably high stakes that are involved in managing such patients. There are two lives involved in this. However, I think things are becoming more and more comfortable. Things are changing for us with the new evidence and release of various guidelines, which are making it much more simpler and clearer in this topic. But there's still a significant challenge of counseling our patients prior to conception and counseling them about the safety of medications. And I guess from the patient's perspective, there's significant voluntary childlessness amongst women with IBD that's probably driven by various concerns, and probably by far the most important one is about the safety of the drugs and the outcome for the newborns. Today we are discussing about this topic. We are delving into how IBD affects pregnancy outcomes, how pregnancy affects IBD course. We'll also touch upon fertility, maybe touch briefly on safety of the investigations in a pregnant IBD patient, and of course all important aspect of medications in pregnancy and breastfeeding, and hopefully end by talking briefly on vaccinations. And to discuss all this today, we have our wonderful guest, Dr. Mette Hulsgaard, who is Associate Professor of Gastroenterology specializing in IBD reproduction from University Hospital in Denmark. Mette is also Director of National Center for Preconception and Pregnancy in Autoimmune Diseases and was one of the authors for the Global Consensus Statement on IBD and Pregnancy, which was published in Gut last year. Welcome to the podcast, Mette.
Thank you very much, Brad, and thank you for the warm welcome.
Lovely, Mette. Let's start with pregnancy. Pregnancy is unique, and I guess most of our efforts and energy is focused on teratogenicity of the drugs. But there's a lot more to IBD, and there's a lot more to IBD in pregnancy. Can you explain, sort of in various domains, how IBD in pregnancy is different?
Yeah, you're so right. We talk a lot about drugs and risk of congenital abnormalities, but really pregnancy is a period of profound physiological changes involving metabolic, hormonal, immunological, and microbiome adaptations. And these changes can influence the course of IBD during pregnancy. Conversely, IBD may also affect pregnancy outcome, and in particular great importance that active disease during pregnancy is associated with an increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcome. Hence, it is of utmost importance to keep our patients in remission. But pregnancy itself can also alter biological pharmacokinetics, thereby affecting both maternal and infant drug exposure. We have seen that when it comes to the biologics. Some biologics have increased clearance in pregnancy, whereas others have decreased clearance. So, and in addition, I think that's the most important thing, that misperceptions during the conception period and pregnancy is also very common among our patients. Like, for instance, 1/3 of women with IBD consider all IBD medication harmful during pregnancy. And around 75% of our patients are concerned about passing on IBD to the child. And really, the risk of passing on IBD is, the absolute risk is really low, 2 to 5% if only one of the parents have IBD. Of course, 35% in case of both parents have Crohn's or colitis. But these are very important aspects to talk with our patients about during preconception counseling.
Mati, I think what you're talking there is you're shifting the focus from teratogenicity or concerns for drugs towards managing active disease or keeping the disease under control. How important is that? As in, you know, what does active disease do to pregnancy outcomes in IBD?
So firstly, just want to highlight that in case we keep the mother during pregnancy in remission, her likelihood of giving normal, like giving birth to a normal infant is really high. Whereas in case of active disease during pregnancy, the risk of adverse pregnancy outcome and for Crohn's disease, such as stillbirth, but for both Crohn's and colitis, risk of low birth weight, infants small for gestational age and giving birth preterm are significantly higher than compared to women in remission during pregnancy. That's why keeping the woman in remission both prior to pregnancy but also during pregnancy is of utmost importance. But again, we are already now discussing like the pregnancy period. We also have to keep in mind the preconception period, because that is also of utmost importance.
So Mati, let's talk about fertility, sort of preconception. Maybe you can explain both in relation to men and women, and how does the disease affect fertility in patients?
Yeah, so we know that active IBD during the preconception period in women, in case you have active disease, those women have higher infertility rates compared to those with being in remission. So this large British study studied nearly 10,000 women with IBD, and they showed that fertility rate was reduced to 70% in the presence of active disease. So this clearly underscores that keeping our women in remission during the preconception period is also of utmost importance. We have very limited data when it comes to men and fertility. In ulcerative colitis, it seems that the fertility rate in men with ulcerative colitis is similar, both prior to and after being diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. However, in men with Crohn's disease, it seems that the fertility rate or the likelihood of becoming a father is lower in men diagnosed with Crohn's disease compared to men without Crohn's disease.
And Mati, I know active disease is a big factor, but let's say patients with inactive disease, patients with your disease under control, is fertility affected if their disease in remission compared to general population?
Well, there are other factors affecting fertility in women with IBD. Yeah. And those we, of course, have to take into consideration. So we know that women who have undergone pouch surgery experience reduced fertility. And new data actually indicate that this is also the case in case of less invasive laparoscopic surgery. But on the other hand, we know that IVF treatment is very effective in women with IBD. So that's a very good option. So we need to refer our patients to fertility experts in case of pouch surgery or previous pouch surgery. And then there's another aspect which is of great importance, that we know that women with IBD who are older than 30 years of age, they might have a lower ovarian reserve. And this is indicated by a lower anti-müllerian hormone levels compared to women without IBD. And this has been shown in two small studies. And then, of course, this adds to that women in today's day and age, we delay becoming moms. So delayed childbearing is, of course, also a factor that affects fertility and the likelihood of becoming a mom.
So it looks like getting disease under control seems to the keystone, or yeah, disease into remission seems to the keystone. And the other take-home point there is IVF treatments are equally effective or very effective in patients compared to sort of compared to the general population.
Exactly. So IVF treatment is just as effective in women with IBD as in the background population. So yes, it's all about keeping the patient in remission, thereby increasing the likelihood of falling pregnant.
Okay, well, that's a good point to note, Mati. Let's go back to a sort of preconception management. Let's say you have a young woman with IBD in your clinic and you come across, and they don't mention all these things in IBD clinic for some reason, but let's say they discuss about conception. So what's going on in your mind? What are the things that you would do? Maybe on a practical note, how you run your service, and what sort of things are going on in terms of medications? What do you think? What are you thinking about in such patients? So optimizing them before conception.
So before moving to the medical treatment aspect, I always review and discuss with the patient whether she's been pregnant before, because we know that if you've been pregnant before and you had active disease in that previous pregnancy, the likelihood of experiencing disease activity in a subsequent pregnancy is actually increased by threefold. So that's sort of a red flag that I need to keep extra care of this patient in pregnancy in order to ensure remission. And then, of course, I review how the patient is doing on the particular drug they are receiving, like measuring like calprotectin, reviewing the charts. When had this patient endoscopy the last time? Is it time just to do a checkup? If everything is looking fine, then as a rule of thumb, she stay on that particular drug. There are a few exceptions, I'll address that. But it's all about keeping the patient in remission. If there are signs of flaring, then you need to address that and potentially changing the medical therapy, dose optimization, whatever it takes to ensure remission. That's what needed. And another important aspect is, of course, micronutrients. In women who mention they want to fall pregnant or who are pregnant, I always check like iron level, because women with IBD are at increased risk of iron deficiency compared to the background population. But I also check vitamin D levels, B12 and B9, and optimize those micronutrients in case they are lacking. Because that is also a very important part of taking care of women who want to fall pregnant or who are pregnant. It gives a better course of the pregnancy, reduces the risk of maternal morbidity and complications during pregnancy, ensures sufficient growth of placenta and the fetus.
Okay. So the two key points there, Mithi, I picked up is optimizing nutrition and optimizing to ensure that the disease is in remission before you think about conception.
Yes.
And in terms of medications, maybe I don't know whether we could talk about it now or maybe later, but in the preconception medications, what are the medications to avoid? What are the ones to continue?
Yeah, so the main issue is really that the JAK inhibitors and the S1Ps should be avoided during pregnancy. Hence, you need to discontinue treatment with those type of drugs prior to pregnancy. And of course, it's easy to state that in the guideline, you need to avoid JAK inhibitors. But if you have failed all other types of treatment and you are now in remission on a JAK inhibitor, what to do then? So as we have also stated in our new global consensus, that JAK inhibitors and S1Ps for that matter should only be used if there are no other viable option for maternal health. So in case a woman has failed all of the biologics, any of our other standard treatments, then you need to have a detailed discussion regarding pros and cons for continuing the drug during the conception period. Because if you decide to continue that particular drug during the conception period, then you are also going to continue in pregnancy because you have no other medical option to ensure remission. The reason why we are concerned about the JAK inhibitors are that the animal studies, again, bear in mind those were conducted in rabbits and rats, but they indicated increased risk of malformations and for some of the drugs also fetal death. We have not seen that in human data. That's important for me to stress. We, of course, have limited safety data. The drugs we have most data on are tofacitinib and UPA, the two JAK inhibitors. But again, the data we have available is primarily first trimester exposure, but that is also during the organoneogenesis. And again, the data we have not shown any signals of increased risk of malformations. And we have so far, an American colleague and I have collected more than 60 cases now now, not published, only preliminary data at conferences, but 60 cases of exposure to JAK inhibitors throughout pregnancy, where we haven't seen increased risk of either maternal or adverse pregnancy outcome. So those data, although limited, are reassuring, and that needs to be discussed with our patients. Pros and cons for continuation of these drugs during the preconception period and pregnancy. And then, of course, clearly documentations in the medical files, what you have agreed on with your patients. For all the other drugs, there are no negative effects on fertility when it comes to 5-ASA, corticosteroids. Antibiotics can be used for a short period of time, thiopurines as well, and all of the biologics, also the newer biologics and thiopurines as well. And that's for women. When it comes to, we should never forget men when we talk about fertility and pregnancy as well. When it comes to men, one needs to keep in mind that sulfasalazine, although we don't use it as frequent, but in patients with arthritis as well, then sulfasalazine is still a drug which is being used. That actually results in reversible oligospermia. But in case you discontinue sulfasalazine, the sperm count will be within normal range for that particular male within 3 months. So that's important to keep in mind. And another key thing is, because previously we said methotrexate had to be discontinued, that is only the case in women because it increased the risk of malformations. But in men, new data has shown that a low-dose methotrexate therapy does not affect semen parameters or sperm DNA. So men on methotrexate who wants to become fathers can continue this particular drug.
Okay. So the bottom line on that is, in the preconception period, stop JAK or if there's an alternative. Of course, methotrexate should be stopped, and all other drugs can be continued if patients are stable on them.
Exactly.
And with the JAK inhibitors, if there's no other alternative, an individual decision and probably a sort of consultation with somebody who specializes in this, and counseling, I guess, is the most important thing on this one. For the audience, can you just remind us what S1P inhibitors are?
The etrasimod and ozanimod. So we are not using those drugs that much, but they are definitely being used especially ozanimod in a patient who has MS as well, because ozanimod can be used in both sclerosis, but also in ulcerative colitis. So that's definitely an option there. So and etrasimod as well can be used in ulcerative colitis. But I have experience using JAK inhibitors both prior to and during pregnancy. So far, I haven't had any patients on an S1P during pregnancy for now.
Mm-hmm. And Mette, this applies to all the new drugs, IL-23. I don't use these terms. I use the drug names. But anyway, the new drugs, guselkumab, mirikizumab, and risankizumab. So this rule applies to them as well?
No, definitely not. So the new anti-IL-23 inhibitors, risankizumab, mirikizumab, guselkumab, they are all biologics. So large immunoglobulins, which doesn't pass placenta during the first trimester, they start passing actively from around gestation week 15, 16, and throughout pregnancy. Exponential increase during the third trimester. Just like we know for infliximab, adalimumab, ustekinumab, and vedolizumab, they are all biologics. And of course, we have so far limited safety data with these newer biologics, but I am completely at ease by using them in pregnancy because we have such a great knowledge regarding the other biologics, which we have used, like infliximab, have been in use since around year 2000. And we have really seen an exponential increase in the use of TNF-alpha inhibitors, like the biologics, since 2010 and up until now. And we have a lot of safety data regarding its use in pregnancy. We have seen no increased risk of congenital malformations for any of the biologics, no increased risk of adverse pregnancy overall. Infants of mothers exposed to biologics are doing really well. Normal development, we have seen that across different studies. And also, in case of monotherapy, no increased risk of infections. And bear in mind, infants, they do get infections. And we have seen infections in infants exposed to biologics as well. But in case of infections, they respond just as well to antibiotics and other treatments like other infants. So definitely continue these drugs in pregnancy. And that also goes for the newer biologics like the anti-IL-23.
Excellent, Mathi. Let's move on to pregnancy. And let's say the patients are exhibiting signs of active disease and you do need to investigate them. Can you talk about the investigations during pregnancy? Which ones are safe? Which ones are to avoid in patients?
Well, to keep it simple, most investigations are safe in pregnancy. Basically, it's only a capsule endoscopy, which should be avoided, but you can perform endoscopy throughout all trimesters in pregnancy. It's low risk, but of course, it should only be performed when needed to guide clinical decision. One important point regarding endoscopy is that the patient should always be in the left lateral position to avoid compression of the inferior vena cava. And I guess most of our patients are always in the left lateral position, but sometimes you do change position, and that's where you need to keep in mind in case of a pregnant patient, especially during the second part of the pregnancy, always left lateral position. Because if you do suppress the inferior vena cava, it may lead to maternal hypotension and reduced placental perfusion. And you need to avoid that. I want to highlight, I think it was in the Red Journal, American Journal of Gastroenterology, in 2025, there is an excellent article on endoscopy in pregnancy. So highly recommendable to search for that article if you do a lot of endoscopy in pregnant patient. So when it comes to CT and MRI without gadolinium, those can also be performed in pregnancy to guide clinical decision. And in intestinal ultrasound, we use that increase in our IBD patient, and it's very accurate during the first and the second trimester of pregnancy. It's more challenging in the third trimester, especially when it's difficult to visualize the sigmoid colon and the terminal ileum. But it's a great tool also to visualize also for the patients that look, there's actually signs of active disease and we need to alter the medical treatment based on these findings.
But if you have a choice between you said CT was safe and you absolutely need to do some imaging on this patient, even if you have a choice, you work in a center where you can get an MRI scan in a day, would you choose an MRI scan versus a CT?
Yeah, well, if there's no waiting list and it's easy to get and you can get a description of it shortly after it's been performed, then an MRI without gadolinium would, of course, be the choice of scan. But again, if that's not feasible, then a CT is still it's a very, very low dose exposure of mom and infant. And if you are in doubt whether there might be an abscess or anything, then perform the CT. It's important that you get the right sort of answers to guide your clinical decision and treatment of the patient.
And with the calprotectin, would you trust it similar? Are there any changes during pregnancy? Would you trust it the way you would interpret it in a non-pregnant person? So are there any physiological changes that affect calprotectin at all?
Yeah, so I'm really glad you highlight that, Brad, because we know that, as you also indicate here, that CRP and the leukocyte count is increased in pregnancy just as a result of being pregnant because of the physiological changes. So having just slightly elevated inflammation markers in blood tests might not be due to active disease, more as a result of being pregnant. Whereas calprotectin, we've shown that beforehand, is not affected by pregnancy. So we can actually use calprotectin to guide clinical decision and using the same cutoff as in the non-pregnant patient.
So Mathi, I know we've already spoken fairly in depth on medications, use preconception. We'll continue the same theme of medications in pregnancy. Take us through each class of drugs and just mention whether you would continue them in pregnancy and breastfeeding, or whether you would initiate such class of drugs during pregnancy and breastfeeding, and would you use it in case of active disease. If you just go through each class of drugs and mention their safety data.
Yeah. So first of all, always folic acid supplements in a patient who wants to fall pregnant. That's important. And also during pregnancy. When it comes to amino salicylic acids like 5-ASA, that is safe and does not affect fertility, can be continued throughout pregnancy, also at the highest dose, and also during breastfeeding. Of course, folic acid supplementations at a higher dose in case of sulfasalazine. When it comes to corticosteroids, it can be used prior to, during, and during pregnancy, and also during breastfeeding. Minimize the dose and always apply a steroid-sparing therapy. We have seen in a large Taiwanese study, but also in the Piano Registry, Prospective Registry, that in case of exposure, especially during the second and third trimester of pregnancy, that was the case in the Piano cohort, infants exposed to corticosteroids are at increased risk of infections during the first year of life. However, if corticosteroids are needed, they should be used in order to ensure remission, but shortest possible duration. Antibiotics, that can be used as well, but in case of infections like fistulas or pouchitis, again, a short course, both during pregnancy and during lactation as well. When it comes to thiopurines, there wasn't a FDA warning, I think, in 2024, stating increased risk of intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. I actually always mention this to our patients because some of our patients, they look at the internet and they see this warning and they get deeply concerned and they might stop the treatment. So address it and say, like, look, the risk of intrahepatic cholestasis in pregnancy is in general very low, around 1%. And these smaller studies indicated increased risk of cholestasis in case of thiopurine exposure. The risk is around 6-7%, so low. So I continue, in case of monotherapy with thiopurines, I continue this during pregnancy, but I recommend control liver enzymes at least every trimester, and you can consider also monitoring metabolites. But never increase the dose with increase in weight during pregnancy. So keep the pre-pregnancy dosing, that's important. And of course, if you have a patient who's on combination therapy, like infliximab and with thiopurine, consider stopping the thiopurine. Is it really needed to keep the patient in remission? But of course, this discussion would be best prior to pregnancy and not during pregnancy. And methotrexate, we discussed that before, that this should be discontinue prior to pregnancy, at least 1 to 3 months prior to conception. If I rarely have experienced patients falling pregnant with methotrexate, then referral to the obstetric department, extra scan, discontinue the treatment, initiate another type of treatment, another like a biologic, which is perfectly safe during pregnancy. So, and that sort of leads on to the biologics, all of the biologics, the TNF-alpha inhibitors, the anti-integrins, the anti-IL-23, and also the newer anti-IL-23, which we discussed before, like the mirikizumab, risankizumab, guselkumab, all of these can be continued throughout pregnancy. We have, as I highlighted, excellent data on infants exposed during pregnancy, and they're doing really well and no increased risk of infections. So please continue in pregnancy and also whilst breastfeeding. And it seemed, and I highlight this both during pregnancy and just after giving birth again, because it seems that our women, they accept they need these drugs during pregnancy, but once they've given birth and they're breastfeeding their child, they start to get concerned about, is this really safe? And yes, these drugs can be continued throughout breastfeeding. There's this rule of thumb saying that if a drug can be measured, that the drug measurement in maternal milk is less than 10% of what you can measure in the blood, then you can continue the drug. For all of the biologics, what you can measure in the milk is less than 1%. So these biologics penetrate poorly into breast milk, and they are not designed to be absorbed from the GI tract either. So really the exposure of the infant is extremely low. And another key point, sort of just reassuring that these drugs can be safely used whilst breastfeeding, is that when looking at an infant exposed to these drugs during pregnancy, looking at the clearance of these drugs in the infants, breastfeeding did not affect time to clearance. So really it's safe to use biologics whilst breastfeeding. And finally, for the JAK inhibitors, tofacitinib, UPA, and filgotinib, again, use only, as we discussed, if there's no other viable option to maintain maternal health, keeping the woman in remission during pregnancy. I have actually also initiated treatment during the second and third trimester with a JAK inhibitor in pregnancy because we had no other viable option in order to ensure remission in case of severe active disease. But when it comes to breastfeeding, we have done extensive investigations for both tofacitinib and for UPA. And although the relative infant exposure is around 3 to 4%, there is also all the active metabolites, and we know the absorption from the infant gut is really high, and we don't know how these drugs actually affect the developing immune system in the neonate. And because there's a great option like bottle feeding the infant, I highly recommend, as we have also stated in the global consensus, that in case of treatment with JAK inhibitors, but also S1Ps during the breastfeeding period, then this woman should not breastfeed. Bottle feeding is the best. Formula feeding is the best option for those women. We have no lactation data for either ozanimod and etrasimod, so the S1Ps. So until we have data, breastfeeding should be avoided as well.
Okay. So the take home, Matthijs, IVSA is continue and safe, thiopurine safe, but monitor more. Of course, methotrexate would have stop if they fall pregnant, avoid JAK inhibitors, avoid S1P receptor modulators, but all the other anti-TNFs, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, newer IL-23, which is mirikizumab, risankizumab, continue, and corticosteroids, try to minimize the dose by replacing. I'm assuming that instead of continuing low-dose corticosteroids, you'd rather initiate a biological or treatment rather than using a low-dose steroid. So you would want to minimize the steroids as much as possible. Is that sort of the take home?
That's spot on. Really, if you have active disease in pregnancy, we have highlighted that in the ECHO guideline and also in the global guideline, you need to treat active disease aggressively, just as in the non-pregnant patients, even more so, I think, in pregnant patients, it's hands-on. So really initiate new types of treatments in pregnancy. That also goes for biologics. And of course, biological naive, infliximab, adalimumab, fast-acting biologics in order to ensure remission, you might then not even need to use steroids. Or then, in case of steroids is needed as bridging, shortest possible duration. What I've done also when it comes to, for instance, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, but also more recently, risankizumab, mirikizumab, and guselkumab, the anti-IL-23s, that initiate this treatment in pregnancy, and then a course of budesonide, like that, because that bridging to ensuring remission on a biologic is a great option as well. But in case of systemic corticosteroid is needed, then shortest possible duration. But again, the main focus should always be ensuring remission. So never use low dose of corticosteroids just to ensure remission. Then you need to alter the treatment. Initiate biologics if needed.
Okay, that's a very good way to put it. Well, a couple of miscellaneous things I just want to bring up. In preparation, I was just going through your consensus statement. Something stuck me, which I was totally unaware of, is about aspirin use. Can you mention about this and why are you talking about it in the consensus statement?
Yeah, this is new in the consensus statement as well. There has been different like national recommendation regarding the use of low dose aspirin in women with IBD. And I'm really happy about that we have summarized the data available in the global consensus. And we have one global recommendation now. And really, women with IBD should be started on a low dose of aspirin between gestation week 12 and 16. So always initiate low dose aspirin prior to gestation week 16 in order to reduce risk of preeclampsia. Women with IBD, especially women with Crohn's disease, are at increased risk of preterm preeclampsia and early onset preeclampsia. And those are really the conditions we need to be aware of because they are high risk for both mom and infant. And by starting a low dose of aspirin, we reduce the risk markedly. We have also seen that women with IBD who have active disease, they're at increased risk of preeclampsia. Hence, also women with ulcerative colitis needs to be started on a low dose of aspirin. So again, to keep it simple, in order to reduce the risk of preeclampsia in women with IBD, you need to start a low dose of aspirin prior to gestation week 16. And then, of course, one can discuss discontinuing the treatment around gestation week 37 in order to reduce the risk of bleeding close to term. But really, of utmost importance, please do start your patients or the obstetrician should start it. But either the gastroenterologist or the obstetrician should start a low dose of aspirin in IBD patients.
Okay, that's a good point, Mate. I think it was something that was completely new, I thought. Hi, it's Pradeep here from After the Recording. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, our conversation with Mate ran much longer than we planned. And rather than cutting it back, we thought we'd release it in two parts. So part two will be out on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. We continue our conversation, the exciting conversation that we've had so far. We delve into some difficult conversations where I discuss with Mete in situations where you ran out of all advanced options and the only option left for a disease flare during pregnancy is JAK inhibitor. How would she deal with such a situation? Would she use JAK inhibitors in such a situation, or would you give low-dose steroids, or would you live with the active disease? So these are difficult questions and difficult answers for Mete to discuss, but we talk about that. We also discuss about surgery in acute severe colitis in the episode. So please tune back in on the 2nd of September for continuation of the second part of this episode. Until then, why not listen to some of the older episodes? Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.